Blue Jays baseball.
Hi, this is Ben Francisco, and you're listening to Blue Jays baseball on the Blue Jays radio network.
2-1 pitch, hit on the ground to the right side, through a base hit. Coming in to score, Escobar. Here's Bautista, throw to the plate. He scores, standing up. To third, Encarnacion. Lowry back to first with a two-run single. And the Blue Jays lead it 4-0 here in Kansas City.
And that was more than they would need. A four-run fifth inning. Brett Lowry with that two-run single. He would later walk and steal home on the front end of a double steal with J.P. Arencibia as the Blue Jays beat the Royals 4-3. Francisco Cordero comes on to close it out with Sergio Santos on the disabled list. And with one out, walks Unieski Betancourt, which is really, really hard to do. Then gives up a double to Jeff Francoeur, a ground single off Cordero's glove by Mike Moustakas, put the tying run on first and scored that third Kansas City run. But on the next pitch, Cordero got pinch hitter Brian Peña to bounce into a 4-6-3 double play to end it, started by Omar Vizquel in his first start as a Blue Jay. Jays beat the Royals 5-3. They are 4-0 in Ricky Romero's starts, and they have won three straight for the first time this season. I'm Mike Wilner. This is the Blue Jays Talk. The Jays can sweep a four-game series with the Kansas City Royals tomorrow night. Brandon Morrow against lefty Bruce Chen, who does tend to give the Blue Jays fits. It's true. But right now, the Jays 9-6 through 15 games, 97-win pace on the season, tied for first in the AL East with the New York Yankees, half a game ahead of the Tampa Bay Rays and a game up on the Baltimore Orioles. Things are looking pretty good. Are they sounding pretty good to you? Let's check. Eric is in Sudbury. Welcome to the Blue Jays Talk.
Hi, thanks. What I wanted to talk about is just I've been really impressed with the Jays' ability to manufacture runs this year. I think they've had maybe two games where they've had over 10 hits, yet they're still averaging over five runs a game. That's one of the things I wanted to go talk about.
What's crazy is that they've been hitting so well with runners in scoring position, aside from those two games against Tampa Bay. Today they were 4-for-12. They're leading the league in hitting with runners in scoring position, and that's where a lot of these runs are coming from.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I think they're doing pretty well to start the season anyway.
Yeah, no question about it. I don't know how much manufacturing runs they're doing by the conventional wisdom definition of the term. It's not like they're stealing a ton of bases. They're certainly not doing a lot of bunting, which is awesome.
Not in that sense, but just timely steals. Like, even look at today, that double steal to get that extra run in the ninth inning. Just the way they're being able to do it, so...
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you, Eric. It's a good thing. And you know what? They're using the hit and run a lot. Even J.P. Arencibia was asked to do it yesterday, the hit and run. It happened again today with Colby Rasmus skipping over a ground ball by Brett Lowry there in the ninth inning. So that's the kind of stuff that I love to see. I love bunting for base hits. I love hitting and running. Smart base stealing. And the Blue Jays are doing that. Except for the bunting for base hits thing. I don't think they have one of those yet. Blake is in Peterborough listening on our flagship station, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Welcome to the Blue Jays Talk.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah, and the other nice thing is we seem to have the Blue Jays seem to have a lot of guys on the team that can employ, you know, diverse array of strategies, whether it be trying to drop down a bunt for a hit. They haven't, but, you know, the nice combination of speed and power on this team.
Even with Edwin. I mean, Edwin's stolen a bunch of bases.
Well,
which is crazy.
I know, it is crazy, and he's obviously producing really well with the bat and settled into the DH, and I like, you know, I think as far as just having guys to hang out with and chat with, there's a nice contingent of Latin American or whatever, I'm not sure what the term is, players on the team, and I think, you know, guys like Escobar and Encarnacion, I think they're both benefiting from that on the club. But anyways, I have two quick questions. First of all, in your opinion, if you had to guess, will Snyder be here because of an injury or because he plays his way back up onto the big club?
Well, someone has to play his way off the big club for Snyder to play his way on the big club. And I know that a lot of people are very distressed about the season that Eric Thames is having, but I don't know that he's really played his way off the team yet. It's interesting because when you talk about Snyder, when Alex Anthopoulos talks about him. He talked the other day about how Brett Laurie was hitting 430 in April last year in Las Vegas. They didn't call him up. They weren't going to call him up until June, and maybe insinuating that the same thing may happen with Snyder. Thames is having basically the same year that he had last year, although the power just hasn't shown up yet. He's got the same. He's got a better on base this year than he had last year when he quote unquote earned that left field job. So, and today, in fact, they pinch hit with him in the eighth inning, knowing that they wouldn't be able to replace him defensively in left field for the rest of the game in a tight game. So that's another move in Thames' favor. Snyder's tearing it up. He's leading the Pacific Coast League in OPS. He's doing everything you could possibly want for him. He is an above-average defender in the outfield who doesn't have to be replaced late in close games. But as of now, I think that the Blue Jays are inclined to leave him down there for a bit and let him continue to just tear it up. And maybe you're right. Maybe there will come a point where they just can't leave him down in AAA anymore.
And I wasn't insinuating that Thames has played his way off at all. This doesn't really matter, but I love his attitude. Ever since he came up last year, I've really kind of been a fan of Thames. And, you know, he doesn't play a great left field. I don't think as many balls drop around him as you might think, but he does not make it look smooth out there.
He's a lot smoother than he looked last year, though, except for those two plays.
Yeah. Yes, I suppose. I just had a question about bullpen use. We've kind of seen two different strategies employed here lately. John Farrell, I don't know if it's a more laissez-faire approach, but, you know, kind of let a guy come in, pitch two innings, maybe three. And then you saw the Joe Maddon where it's very situational. And now, obviously, is it Ned Yost, the manager of Kansas City?
Yep.
I mean, he's totally blown his bullpen out in the last three games. You know, just where do you come out on that as far as situational, matching up lefty-righty? Is it all just about how the pitcher does against certain opponents, or how would you approach that?
I have a hard time with the whole how he does against certain opponents because very, very rarely are you going to get a sample size big enough to be significant. I mean, it's usually 2, 3, 4 at-bats when you're talking about relievers, so that doesn't really mean anything to me. I think it all depends on the situation, and you know, when the Blue Jays were winning World Series, or at least were winning divisions on a regular basis, they had Dwayne Ward in the eighth, Tom Henke in the ninth. They didn't care that they were both right-handed. They didn't care if there was a left-hander coming up against them or anything like that. They had two guys that they trusted and that they handed the ball to and said, look, you have the eighth, you have the ninth. Then when Henke left after 92, Ward had the ninth, and there wasn't a clear guy in the eighth inning in 1993, but they didn't exactly match it up either. You know, it wasn't Danny Cox against all the righties and Tony Castillo against all the lefties or anything like that. Joe Maddon likes to manage that way. He likes to exploit every possible minute advantage that you may or may not have for various reasons. Not only, I don't think, because of strategy, but I think also to try to get in the team's heads. As far as the Blue Jays are concerned, they have really two terrific weapons in the bullpen in Casey Jansen and Darren Oliver. You have a righty who pitches well against lefties and a lefty who pitches well against righties, or at least who gets good performance. So I think that you can turn around switch hitters that way to their weaker side with either one of them, and you can kind of match up that way. But in the perfect Blue Jay universe, Francisco Cordero gets the eighth no matter what, and Sergio Santos gets the ninth no matter what. And I'm okay with that until such time as they show that they shouldn't be doing it that way. So I think that it depends on your personnel. It depends on the mindset of your manager. But I don't know that there's any one perfect way to do it. If you've got two strong relievers, then let them go. And if you think you're better off matching up, if you're in a situation where you have a righty who has a hard time against lefties, or if you have a lefty who's got a hard time against righties, then you're going to have to match up. But thank you for the call. Appreciate it a lot. Let's go to Brandon in Toronto, listening on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, you're on the Blue Jays Talk.
Hi, Mike. Let me start off by saying that I am a firm believer in Aaron Sebia. My question for you, though, is it would have been a more pertinent question last week, I guess, when he was still struggling. But, I mean, with two fairly good-looking catchers in the pipeline, with the emergence of the Twitter world and everything, and the franchise player they've seemed to make Aaron Sebia into, how do you think that affects the decision you might have to make eventually when you say enough is enough and you can hit 20 home runs, but a 175 average is just not enough?
Well, first of all, there's no reason at all to believe that J.P. Arencibia is going to hit 175. It's not something that's ever happened before for him in his pro career. And in fact, except for last year and the 1 year in Vegas where he had like eye problems and a kidney issue, he's been a really good hitter for batting average for his entire career. And I'm not saying he's going to hit 300 or anything, but I don't believe that there's any rational reason to think that he's going to be a guy who struggles to hit 200 at all.
More so my question would be is just the way that they've kind of made him into a franchise player. Would it be harder for AA to sever ties or at least demote? No?
No. Demote. I mean, there's no reason to, you know, that's the thing. If you're thinking about that, you shouldn't be thinking about that. That's not going to happen, regardless of how active JP is on Twitter or, you know, how wonderful a personality he has. He is in zero danger of losing his job this year. None whatsoever, unless he gets hurt. But as far as maybe moving him, a trade possibility, I know a lot of people
are...
That
would be my next question.
Right. I know that there are people who are saying, well, Travis d'Arnaud is coming up really fast and you're going to have to make room for him. You got to get rid of JP. I would think, first of all, that, you know, Travis Snyder would be a huge cautionary tale for that. Colby Rasmus as well. But secondly, Anthopoulos doesn't operate on emotion at all. He tries to eliminate that from any part of his consideration. He's worried about improving his team. And in fact, they make most of their spring training decisions in February, because they don't want to be swayed by a guy who has a hot 2 weeks in spring or something like that. They try to remove every bit of emotion out of their entire process to make clear-headed, rational decisions. And that will apply, too, if the opportunity or the necessity to trade JP comes up.
Makes sense to me.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
No problem. There you go. Thank you, Brandon. It is a clear-headed, rational beast what runs your Toronto Blue Jays, who beat the Kansas City Royals 5-3 today, by the way, their first three-game win streak of the season, and they finally break that pattern of win-2, lose-2, win-2, lose-2 all season long. Joe in Ottawa is listening on Sportsnet590.ca. How you doing, Joe?
Pretty good, Mike. I'm trying to be clear-headed and rational, but it's pretty darn exciting when your starter goes 8 innings and you knock the other guy out before he completes 5.
Well, it's a very huge difference between who Ricky Romero is and who Danny Duffy is, but Romero is continuing to emerge as that ace-level, top-of-the-rotation guy.
But I think it's also an example of, I believe, the two objectives that John Farrell set for the year, which he wanted his starters to go deeper into games generally, and I think the Jays starters are doing that.
Absolutely.
And meanwhile, he wanted us to grind out at bats and let's get into the other team's bullpen. And I honestly think, despite the offensive struggles, that we have been grinding out at bats.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. You're absolutely right. I mean, look at that game, the home opener against Boston. Felix DuBrant was the pitcher, and the Blue Jays wound up losing that game. But they got DuBrant out of there because he threw 100 pitches in 5 innings. And Danny Duffy was the same way. He was over 100 pitches today, I think, and he didn't even make it through the 5th inning. So, they're doing exactly that. They are grinding. Yeah, Duffy threw 113 pitches, and he didn't make it out of the 5th inning. They're having fantastic at-bats. The results aren't always great, but the process is, and the more you can get to those 5th and 6th inning relief pitchers, the better off you're going to do.
I think so. It almost makes me wonder, in a world where we've got so many baseball stats, maybe that's a new stat we need, is almost like the grinding gap between teams in each game, you know?
You come up with the number, and if it works, I'll be all over it for you.
Oh, I appreciate that. And I just have a question going back 2 games ago when John Farrell put in Rajay David as a pinch runner for J.P. Arencibia. So then Mathis becomes the goes in as the catcher in the next inning. But if Mathis gets hurt,
yep.
Who will become the catcher? Because we don't have Johnny Mack. I think he was like the sort of pseudo third catcher on the Jays.
Yeah, I think it's Alan Ashby. It might even be me. I'm not sure, honestly, who that third catcher would be for the Blue Jays. I know that Brett Laurie was drafted as a catcher, but I can't imagine they would ever put him back there and expose him to the risk of injury. I really, you know, you look up and down this roster and you wonder who it would be. I have no clue who that third catcher should be for the Blue Jays, but I'll ask. Next time I see John Farrell, I will ask him.
Well, if you get that answer, I'll work on this new stat we're going to have to come up with. Thanks for taking my call.
Excellent, Joe. Thank you very much. Blue Jays beat the Royals 5-3 today. Chris is in Oakville listening on our flagship, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. You're on the Blue Jays talk, Chris.
Hey, Mike. Just about a couple comments and then ask you a question. I personally think that given what you see on other teams that have won wild cards, would have won divisions, World Series, not going to mention that we're going to make it there this year, but you know, there's a certain formula that a pitching staff I think needs to have, and ultimately you look at teams that have won those things that I mentioned, and your ace has 20 wins, your number two starter has 16 wins, and so on and so forth. And my ultimate question is, I think Anthopoulos needs to make a move, but I don't know what that is. But ultimately I think with a rotation that is young and has potential, Romero's maybe a 20-game winner. I think he definitely can win 20 games. Morrow, I think, is, if you compare him to other number two starters, probably is maybe a little bit sub-average, but has the potential to win 18 games type of thing. What's that extra move that Anthopoulos needs to make to essentially close out what is currently sort of a revolving number three and four position in the rotation?
Oh, I don't think Henderson Alvarez is revolving anywhere. I think he is the number three starter and eventually may put up those number two starter type numbers. And Kyle Drabek can get there, but obviously he's still very much a work in progress. It's an interesting thing. I don't like to kind of break things down in as far as pitcher wins go. I think pitcher wins is a completely useless stat, and they really don't have control over it as much as you'd like. So it's taking that out of the equation, instead of saying, well, your ace is a guy who's going to win 20 games and your number two star is going to win 16 games. It's, you know, you kind of know what you have when you see it, where your ace is going to pitch deep into games, give you an excellent chance to win every night. Your number two starter should do the same thing, maybe not quite as good results as the number one guy. But for me, you're right. It's not a perfect team. There aren't any, though. There are moves to be made, but what are those moves? You know, you could add a number two type starter because Brandon Morrow's not quite there yet and move everybody down a spot. But then, you know, you lose the opportunity to see a Kyle Drabek breakthrough or a Dustin McGowan to get innings once he comes back.
Yeah.
I think you have to let things play out a little bit because I don't like the idea of denying innings to guys who could wind up being really, really good for you that, you know, you don't have to give up an asset to acquire.
Absolutely. I think,
right? So if Brandon Morrow can emerge, if Kyle Drabek can emerge, if Romero and Alvarez can stay who they are, then I don't think you need to add any starting pitching on this team.
No, yeah, I definitely agree that, like, the potential's there, and it's right, a very exciting situation. That
Yeah, but you have to give them the opportunity to try to achieve their potential. And I think if you get caught up in, oh my God, we have to win this year, and if we don't win this year, then everything's just going to go to hell, then you make those mistakes and you wind up losing assets in order to try to improve when you might not have had to lose those assets in the first place.
Yeah, and I think that ultimately, like, the potential's there and it's very exciting, and I think making a move might, as you said, sort of shun away potential development and growth in what we have. And it's sort of difficult to understand of if you looked at on a chart of, you know, whether we're developing, whether we're in the middle, or whether we have the potential sort of year going ahead. It's hard to determine, you know, where are we right now,
right?
Because our team has the potential to have a three-starter rotation with 18 to 20 wins in those guys, and every single game giving a team a chance to win. It's I guess that's a difficult decision. That's why we're not general managers.
Well, it's why you have to move along the development track, Chris. And I appreciate the call. I know that, you know, it's tough to hear. Be patient. But you got to be patient, and not think that if the Blue Jays don't get to the playoffs this year, that all is lost. Because there's a better chance that they won't get to the playoffs this year than that they will. And that's okay, as long as things continue to move in the right direction. Alan is in Toronto. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Mike. I sincerely hope Jeremy Jeffries is okay. That was quite a savage one-humper by Jose Bautista.
Hit really hard. I'm not sure if it hit him in the hip or the kidney or the rib cage or the elbow.
Yeah.
That's not fun.
Kansas City, 20 years ago, they got off to a 1-16 start, and it kind of looks like they're taking off from where they left off there. You know,
it's just too bad. You know what? Their pitching hasn't come around to the point where their young hitting is arriving, but they're going to be a very good team. Gordon and Butler and Hosmer and Moustakas are all very, very good hitters. They have pitching coming up. It's just not there yet. But I think, you know what? Honestly, the Kansas City Royals could very well still finish second in the AL Central this year.
I want to talk about Jose Valverde. Last year, he was 49-0. Mariano Rivera, Trevor Hoffman, and Lee Smith, my top three. Never had a year like that. Gagne had one in 2003, but you can even go back further than that. Fingers and Eckersley did not have a year like that. Do you see any Blue Jay possibly having a year like that, or is he really that much head and shoulders above? You think he probably had that kind of year because he's in the Central as opposed to the East? If he was, I guess I'm being hypothetical, but
yeah, no, he had that kind of year last year because he was lucky. He had Jose Valverde had 49 saves and 49 opportunities last season, and yet this season he blew his first save opportunity of the year. If you look up the numbers, and you mentioned some great ones, you know, Mariano Rivera and Trevor Hoffman and Dennis Eckersley and Lee Smith, great relievers that never went through a season without blowing a save, but all those guys had better years than Valverde had last year. They had better whips than he did over a full season, better ERAs than he did over a full season. Jose Valverde got lucky, plain and simple. You cannot go through a whole season without blowing a save unless you get really, really lucky. And that's what happened. Guys are going to blow saves. In 1987, Tom Henke was 0-6. But he still led the major leagues in saves. Everybody's going to blow a save unless they are really, really lucky. Listening on Sportsnet590.ca, Julius is in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to the program, Julius.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome, and beware the Ides of March.
Yeah, so how are the Blue Jays? They played an amazing series against the Royals.
It's not over yet. One more game.
Oh, it's not over yet?
Nope. Tomorrow night, too.
Do you think they'll be able to play such kind of baseball against the Boston and the Yankees? Do you think they'll be able to play the same game that they've been playing? I mean, John Farrell has been doing an amazing job so far.
Well, I think that's kind of simplistic, though, isn't it? I mean, the Red Sox and Yankees are much, much better teams than the Kansas City Royals. And if, despite how the Red Sox are going right now, and if you play the same game, you might not win. I don't think the Blue Jays are capable of sweeping a season series against the Red Sox or the Yankees, but I think they might be capable of sweeping a season series against the Royals, although that's even a stretch too. They may well lose tomorrow, play the same games they played today.
Right. So in order to contend, do you think they'd have to for sure be able to take 2 out of 3 from a Red Sox or Yankee series, but they have to...
Every series? Series, you think?
Not every series, but in order to contend, they'd have to be able to at least take 2 out of 3 from them once in a while.
Sure. Yeah, it would be very, very tough to contend if the Blue Jays lost every series to the Red Sox, the Yankees, and the Rays. If they went no better than 6-12 against those three, each of those three teams, there's no chance, almost no chance, that they contend unless they do amazingly well the rest of the time. But I do. I think the Blue Jays are just as good as any team in the American League East. I don't know if they're just as good as the Tigers or the Rangers. But I think they're just as good as Boston, just as good as Tampa, just as good as the Yankees. And I think they'll play though all those teams pretty evenly all season long. And it's going to be a lot of fun to watch. Thank you for the calls. Apologies to those of you to whom we could not get. Blue Jays, a 5-3 win over the Kansas City Royals, and they will go for the four-game sweep tomorrow night. It's On to Postgame Show on the Blue Jays Radio Network. Welcome back to Baseball Control in Toronto. I'm Mike Wilner. The Blue Jays beat the Kansas City Royals 5-3, and they are now in position for a four-game sweep with a win tomorrow night. They'll send Brandon Morrow to the mound against Bruce Chen. Morrow looking for his first win of the season. Let's take a look at the scoreboard. We have had a few rainouts, a couple of them in the National League, but one in the American League and a big one because it was supposed to be Sunday Night Baseball. The New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox rained out, which can be nothing but good for the Boston Red Sox, who got humiliated yesterday, becoming the first team in almost 80 years to blow a 9-run lead and wind up losing by as many as 6 runs. The Baltimore Orioles are trying to stave off a sweep at the hands of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. They have 2 runs in the top of the 8th inning, finally get on the board, and they lead the Angels now 2-1. Bottom of the 6th, Oakland over Cleveland 4-1. And it is the White Sox leading Seattle 5-4 in the top of the 6th, right after a day after they got perfect gamed. Earlier, the Rangers beat the Tigers 3-2-11, and Tampa Bay took down the Twins 6-2. Tomorrow night, 7:30 Eastern, for an 8:10 first pitch, Brandon Morrow and Bruce Chen. Make sure you join us then, and on our flagship station, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. An extra pregame show starting at 7 Eastern. We'll hear from Brian Butterfield and Kelly Johnson. You've been listening to Home Hardware Blue Jays Baseball. This copyrighted broadcast is presented by authority of Rogers Blue Jays Baseball Partnership. It may not be reproduced or retransmitted in any form, and the accounts and descriptions of this game may not be disseminated without the express written consent of Rogers Blue Jays Baseball Partnership or the Blue Jays Radio Network.